Welcome to Studio Tulsa.
I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We started the new year with a couple of interviews here on Medical Monday related to the science of nutrition and how it's often underappreciated in the medical world. Today, we have another installment with one of the greatest legends in the field. T. Colin Campbell is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, where he's been an active researcher for more than four decades. He's also the founder and namesake of the nonprofit T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, whose mission is a commitment to increasing awareness of the extraordinary impact that food has on the health of our bodies, our communities, and our planet. Campbell is most famous for his 2005 book, The China Study, which detailed years of his research collaborations between Cornell, Oxford University, and the Chinese Academy of Preventive Medicine, exploring the relationship between nutrition and cancer, heart, and metabolic diseases. With millions of copies sold and in print, The China Study remains one of the best-selling nutrition books of all time, and the work underpinning it convinced Campbell of the merits and health benefits of a whole food, plant-based diet, which we'll define during this interview. Despite growing up on a dairy farm, Campbell has followed the science and spent the latter part of his career debunking diet fads and the copious misinformation and marketing that comes to us from food companies and trade associations. His latest book, co-authored with Nelson Disla, is simply called The Future of Nutrition. It's an insider's look at the science, why we keep getting it wrong, and how to start getting it right. In the book, Campbell details what he thinks are the weaknesses of government nutrition recommendations and has suggestions for how we depoliticize science and information around the foods we consume going forward. Dr. T. Colin Campbell, Cornell professor and co-author of The Future of Nutrition, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. T. Colin Campbell, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you tell us what you mean by whole food plant-based diet. And I've seen you quoted, this is not exactly a vegan diet, but tell us what you mean by that.
Well, whole food plant-based is there are two words that are key. One is whole, so we should eat the food in a whole food form if possible. That doesn't mean we can't cut it up and cook it and stuff like that. It just means we should be consuming all the nutrients in that food more or less at the same time. That's the word whole. The plant-based, vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, some nuts, and so forth. And so those two words, for me, having been in the policy arena, especially for so many years, those two words really capture most of the effect that we're going to see.
Okay, and you've been you're a career-long scientist. You're a professor emeritus of nutritional biochemistry, which means you've really focused a lot of your career on the elements of nutrition, the biochemicals that kind of make up what we eat and how we sustain ourselves and how we grow. So a lot of your work, or what you're perhaps most famous for, even though you've had a long and distinguished career, was your best-selling book, The China Study, which I think came out in 2005. And you were, I guess, fortunate enough to co-author that with one of your sons. Can you, for our listeners who aren't aware of the China Study, tell us in broad strokes what that research showed?
Well, in reality, it covered a lot of years, as you indicated. I finished my, I started graduate school at Cornell in the same area, more or less, that is nutrition, dental, and health, in 1956. So, I'm going on 66 years, to be honest about it. I've been in the field the entire time. Finally, and after having a very active research program, mostly at Cornell University, doing some international work, and also being in policy development in Washington, those kind of things. Finally, in the early 2000s, I got a lot of pushback through the years from obvious places. And it was a little bit disconcerting at times. And so my wife just told me, she said, why don't you sit down and write a book? Just tell her to stop complaining. So I wrote the book in the early 2000s, and I recounted in the China Study what I had learned over those years from many different perspectives. And I wasn't sure when I finished writing the book. I wanted to make it scientific, so that 700 and some references in there, if you will. I wanted to make it scientific and valid. But I didn't want to go over their heads. And finally, I sort of said in the book, I didn't know how well it's going to do. I said, just try it. You don't need to believe all the technical stuff here. Just try it. And so we had already determined that we knew what happened when you try it. And then my colleagues, Dr. Asselton, Dr. McDougall, Dr. Ornish, they were demonstrating for heart disease patients in particular, pretty remarkable effects. So I wrote the book in 2005, and then, of course, in the subsequent books I wrote, I was up on that same idea.
Yeah, so if you don't mind sharing, what were some of the findings when you were in this collaborative project with a university in China? You looked at the provinces of China and how they, because they kept very accurate statistics, you were able to show very strong correlations with what Chinese folks were eating and how it impacted their health and their longevity. What were some of those associations?
The study was actually done at that time in 130 villages across the country. We repeated the study a second time and included Taiwan as well. So we got up to 170, and we measured a total of what we say is 367 items of information, if you will, you know, having access to about 4 to 5 dozen different mortality rates, plus a lot of things we measured, the blood and the urine and questionnaires and so forth and so on. We had a monumental amount of information having to do mostly with nutrition and disease, how the two relate. We measured nutrition various ways, in the blood samples, you know, questionnaires, actually analyzing food samples and so forth. So we had a lot of information. I did the China study primarily because I had learned in the laboratory during the 60s and 70s that the effect of animal protein in particular really had a pretty remarkable effect on cancer development in experimental animals. We studied that extensively and published a lot on that. And so when I had a chance in the early 80s to hook up with a Chinese fellow who was visiting my lab at the time, very distinguished Chinese fellow, I learned about the Chinese having had access to a lot of mortality rates. And so I said, well, why don't we just get together and do a study on that? We'll go to China, and we'll have this joint project, and we'll collect a whole lot of things to see why it is that in certain parts of rural China mostly, why it is in parts of rural China disease rates were so much higher in some areas and so much lower in other areas. I mean, it's a perfect sort of epidemiological setup. So we did that. As I say, in a total of 130 villages, we had a number of people, about 6,500 families, and we just had a monumental amount of information. I really wanted to know if in that human population we might see something different, or I mean something the same or different than what I had found in the lab. Of course, the lab results was indicating that the consumption of animal protein in particular was problematic. It was associated with the formation of cancer and heart disease and so forth and so on. So we obviously had that, and I had that in the back of my mind. And what it turned out that in China, where they consumed very low amounts of animal protein compared to us, still it was enough to really cause some significant changes in blood cholesterol levels and heart disease and what's the disease and so forth and so on. So China was an affirmation, if I may say it that way, of what I was learning in the laboratory. And by the way, the study was between two Chinese academies, of course, and Cornell University, but it also a major player there, too, was Oxford University in England. So it was a four-way institutional relationship, although we actually ended up working with about 24 labs from around the world, analyzing different things for us. We wanted to get the best analyses we could get. And so it became a big project. Lots and lots of things to compare, different kind of disease rates, different kind of diets. And basically what we learned was that the Western type of diet, you know, rich in animal-based foods, lower in plant-based foods, for a whole host, almost infinite numbers of reasons, that kind of diet, the Western animal-rich diet, high in animal protein, of course, high fat, that diet is associated with increasing risk of so-called degenerative diseases like heart disease and cancer and so forth.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He's Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University and co-author of the new book, The Future of Nutrition. Dr. Campbell, in this book, The Future of Nutrition, one of the most interesting chapters came early on, your second chapter. You call it The Hidden History of Nutrition and Disease. And I got to say, I was pretty surprised, and I think you relate how surprised you were. It sounds like you had, I think it was a sabbatical year or something, and you were actually in the UK, and you delved a little bit into the history of nutrition. And I'll let you tell us, but it was kind of surprising to you to find out that a lot of this work, a lot of this knowledge was actually out there and available, but nobody seemed to know about it as if it had been suppressed. Tell us about Frederick Hoffman's work, for example.
Sure. Let me go back to 1982.
Sure.
I was a member of a 13-member committee of the National Academy of Sciences at that time, where we were asked to come up with a report on diet and cancer. Okay, we published that. It was a very well. I mean, it was sought after report when it came out in 1982, and we were saying things like, hey, we should be eating more vegetables and fruits and that sort of thing, cut down fat intake. And I was very significant, prominent on that committee because I was the one who that actually gave testimony before congressional committees. And I was speaking about my own work, obviously, in addition to the report itself, and pointing out how animal protein is problematic. Well, the criticism I started to get was pretty horrendous, pretty nasty, to say the least. It went on from about 82 until I went away to Oxford in 1985. And it got very bad. So I decided to go to the, rather than getting down about it and that sort of thing, I sort of knew where it was coming from, but I decided to go to the libraries at Oxford and London to see if I could learn something about the history of this field. And when I say this field, I'm talking about the field of nutrition as well as the field of cancer research, which is my other area. And I found some amazing things. Got all the way back to the late 1700s and the 1800s. And I actually got the books out and, you know, pieced together a story that I just found amazing. Just really, truly amazing. And it really helped me greatly to understand why we have so much tension in this country, so much confusion, I should say, too, you know, about the subject of nutrition in health, the nutrition and the practice of medicine, as a matter of fact. So,
yeah,
That's the latest book, I will tell that, yeah.
Well, one of your criticisms is we don't really have any bona fide national effort at nutrition. You know, our medical schools come under criticism quite a bit for not adequately teaching nutrition. And as you point out several times in the book, there's no real medical reimbursement system or payment system, so to speak, for giving sound nutritional advice as part of routine health care. And what was surprising was you note what I'd call a recency bias. That is, you were on this national panel for the National Academy of Sciences, and you know, you thought, not you personally, but I think the committee and many, many scientists or scholars or students think, well, gosh, if anything hasn't been published in the last 6, 8, 10 years, it's way out of date. And you were kind of flummoxed to find very interesting research from, you know, a century ago, and that seemed quite relevant even, you know, today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, nutrition research has been very active for more than a century. And health research in general, food research in general goes back to the middle 1800s and earlier. So, I'm a great fan of history, especially now because I had the chance to see, really looking at those reports, reading the books, you know, how much that information really did set the stage for what we came to believe in the area of nutrition, you know, and health in general in this country, in Western society. But I was interested in your comment, and I know your position, you and your wife.
Yes.
And pointing out that fact that we don't teach nutrition in medical schools. I don't know one in the country that teaches nutrition, certainly not the kind that I'm talking about. And secondly, and this is a big issue, you can correct me on this, by the way. As I understand it, we have about 130 medical specialties, more or less, that's defined by the Medicare system and used for reimbursement and that sort of thing. And you got the CPT codes and ICD codes and that sort of thing. So as I understand, a lot of physicians keep their records or get reimbursement on the basis of, you know, what kind of numbers they're, you know, what kind of codes they're using for their patients' visits. And in any case, there's 130 medical specialties. As you know, one for each disease is disease, sub-disease and so forth. Among the 130 or so of those categories, there's not one called nutrition. And so it makes it very difficult. You, as I say, I really invite you to correct me on this. But if a physician really wants to talk about just nutrition all by itself as a solution to maybe problems, that sort of thing, it's kind of difficult to get the kind of reimbursement I think you can get. My son who wrote the book with me, he's a physician himself, by the way. And so that's my read in general of the profession. And I think it's very sad. You know, physicians are not being educated on nutrition in med schools. There's a reason for that. First and secondly, if they can't get properly reimbursed, I mean, the whole issue kind of dies on the vine. At the same time, at the national level, as far as research is concerned, my territory, the National Institutes of Health is made up of about 27 institutes, you know, one for cancer, one for heart disease, and so forth and so on. There's not one institute that's dedicated to nutrition. So nutrition is not taught as I said, in medical schools first. Secondly, reimbursement is tough. And thirdly, we don't do the kind of research that needs to be done. And so those are three strikes and you're out kind of thing as far as nutrition is concerned.
Yeah, well, I would agree with you as far as the whole healthcare system as a whole. There's really not much in the way you can get reimbursed for nutrition advice in the context of certain illnesses, so GI conditions, gastrointestinal conditions, that is, or in the context of diabetes, there's medical nutrition therapy. And so there are specific instances where you can talk about nutrition, but in general, talking about general nutrition, whether for overall health, preventive health, good nutrition, or even diet. I mean, you can, I suppose, talk about it in the context of obesity, but you have to have specific related conditions as well. So it's rather complex, much more so than it probably should be. And I like your point about the National Institutes of Health. I mean, why don't we have, we do have, and you're critical of the US RDA, those are the recommended daily allowances. And you go a little bit into the history of this about how, for example, what's the US RDA for protein, and you call it a cult of animal protein in the United States. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. RDA means recommended dietary allowance, or recommended daily allowance, actually. And so that's expressed as the amount of a nutrient relative to total calorie intake, the amount of nutrient that should be consumed for good health. That process has been ongoing since 1943, and it's revisited every 5 years. And that documentation is put together by two institutions. One is the National Academy of Science that determines how much of each nutrient should be consumed. The Institute of Medicine at the National Academy of Sciences, to be specific. And secondly, after we know sort of how much each nutrient is needed for good health, that's passed on to the Dietary Guidelines Committee of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who come up with the Dietary Guidelines. You sort of translate nutrient intakes into food intakes. So it's a combo for those two organizations, plus the Department of Health and Human Services, who participates with the USDA in making guidelines. But in any case, that whole system is really deficient in having, nutrition centers, really good professional nutrition centers to talk about nutrition as I know it. Not at all. But they're very deficient in that. And unfortunately, from my experience, and I've had quite a lot of experience at this level, the guidelines that are told to the Americans, for example, are passed on after the committee, sort of the science committee looks at it for, up to 3 to 4 years or so each time. It has to pass the pen of the secretaries. And the secretaries, in turn, are political appointees, obviously, changed with each administration, and they tend to represent corporate interests. And so it's kind of a closed shop. In many ways, we can't say too many things that will in any way impact, let's say, industries, either the agricultural industry or the medical industry. So that's tough. I'm being very very brief in his comments. I mean, there's a lot more to this story than that. But the American public, in a nutshell, is not getting the information on nutrition that can really do amazing things. They're not getting that information at all, really. Except in a fairly distorted, superficial way. So one of my pet peeves, I've been around that barn, and particularly the political arena, for, 30 years, 40 years.
Well, and you share aspects of that in the book. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, and the author, most famously, co-author of The China Study. He is author of this new book, The Future of Nutrition, which we're talking about today. And Dr. Campbell, you mentioned the pushback that you've received for years and years, decades almost, for trying to essentially speak truth to power and truth to industry. And you grew up on a farm and were very close to animals and to the dairy industry. And in fact, at Cornell, it seems as though the dairy industry has a very, and agriculture in general, has a very strong influence, and you have examples of that in the book. You talked about milking two cows every morning in your childhood until, I guess, your father wanted to expand the operation and you went to mechanical milkers, but you had to hand centrifuge the cream to reserve it for butter, and you talked about, you had a strong memory of how hard it was to do that work. And I guess I was just wondering if you could share, I mean, you have a very informed experience with dairy farming in particular, but other kinds of animal husbandry as well. And so it's, you know, in fact, you were, a lot of your life's work has been sort of in contrast to that.
Yeah, I was raised on a farm and milked cows and did all the usual farming, and farming has been in our family for generations. But in any case, I was the oldest and first one to go to way school. My dad only had a couple of years of formal education, so he was anxious for me to get an education. I went away to school. Eventually, I ended up at Cornell University at the graduate level doing graduate work there. And at that time, I did my doctorate actually on a project designed to justify an increase in the consumption of more animal protein, if you will, which is consistent with my background. I mean, after all, milk, meat, and eggs, stuff like that. Now I'm in graduate school, and I'm getting some training in teaching, and first course of teaching was livestock feeding, if you will. And so it went, and it wasn't until after I got my first faculty position at Virginia Tech University, and we're doing work in the Philippines. I was made responsible for coordinating a nationwide program of feeding malnourished children, where they were supposed to get more protein. That's the idea. And so still, I mean, everything's going right in line. But I saw in the Philippine children some evidence that the few children who consume protein like we do in the West, they had a higher risk for getting liver cancer, of all things. Children, liver cancer, that doesn't square. I mean, liver cancer, as you know, it goes middle to older ages. But there it was. And it wasn't very good evidence, but I thought I saw it, and I started checking into it. The more I looked into it, gosh, this evidence is pretty strong. So here I have a responsibility to make sure these kids get more animal protein, and I see this. I had no choice but to go back to the lab in Virginia Tech in those days to get some NIH money to organize a research program, because I wanted to find out, is there any truth to this? I wasn't going to get involved in, you know, pushing animal protein if, you know, that was a problem. That was the beginning of my career, and almost all of my research was funded by the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Cancer Institute. It was generous. I was fortunate to have quite a lot of funding and had a big research group, and so we had a chance over those years to really go to considerable depth to ascertain whether animal protein really had this problem. And if it did, you know, how does it work? And, you know, what's the mechanisms involved in causing these issues? And so as the years passed, it became stronger and stronger. And so that became the central theme of my ideas on nutrition, quite frankly, and the way we eat and the way we eat ourselves.
Well, you relate one story even at your own university about how, for example, the China study being selling, you know, millions of copies got you a lot of publicity from the university. But then there was another instance where essentially the university quashed a story about you internally or being released because of the fact that it ran counter to, was it a dairy company or a large food corporation that had made a donation or to build, was it a laboratory or a building or something? And so you gave an example of essentially feeling somewhat censored.
Yeah, that's right. That was very disturbing. Cornell, incidentally, I have to say, Cornell is my school, and it's a great university, I have to say that. Well, my children, our children, and myself, we have 7 degrees from Cornell, just to indicate how loyal we are to the university. But nonetheless, Cornell is a land-grant school, and like land-grant schools around the country, they are largely beholden to the agriculture industry. And that means getting a lot of support from the federal government, sort of in a sense pushing livestock, doing the research, that sort of thing. So Cornell is no different than anyone else. In fact, it's one of the leading universities in that area. So they're greatly influenced by the dairy industry in particular. In all places. And I had the largest program at Cornell, the most published and so forth and so on. But still, that made me even more vulnerable. The industry kind of got upset with what I was doing. And they had their ways of, pushing their ideas through the university in the form of funding or other sorts of things. So it was not a very pleasant experience, but on the other hand, I love the university. It's a great university.
You maintain that, of course, since you were a tenured professor, you had the freedom in order to speak your mind and speak truth. But in your remedies toward the end of your book, you do suggest that one of your recommendations is to protect and restore academic freedom. And another one is to rescue science from technology and industry. And I work in higher education, and I know that with dwindling public funding for common and higher education, this is something that I think many more educational institutions have cozied up with industry and is, potentially a conflict of interest. So I guess How do you think we can go forward to both protect academic freedom and to lessen our dependence on industry in academe?
Well, you've asked what we used to say in the older days, the $64,000 question. I guess $64 million question. $64 billion, let's say. I had tenure, and that meant I had academic freedom to speak what I thought was truthful. And I had tenure from a very young age, actually, surprisingly. I was in my 30s, and I'm in my 80s now, so I've had it over 50 years. And so I was protected. And there were times when there were people on the outside wanting to get me fired and this and that. But, you know, I had tenure. I could speak my mind on this, which I did. Unfortunately, the whole academic tenure thing is not something not well known to the public. I know there's some problems with the academic tenure system in a way, but it's an appointment for a lifetime if you earn it, you know, after some period of time. And the tenure, back in, there was real data on this. In 1980, something like 70% of the faculty were tenured. That was pretty good. But in 2010, in this particular study, it's a good study, in 2010 it had dropped from 70% to 30% being tenured. Only 9% of the total faculty were, you know, holding a full position, like full professor with tenure, which I have had. So there's a small number of us who are really in a position to be able to, as you say, speak truth to power. It's critical. It's critical. Because if we're not able to do that, and we're expected, you know, being in academic sort of circles, we're often called on for our expertise and that sort of thing. If we can't really speak what we believe to be true, the country suffers. And so the public is not going to be able to get the kind of advice and expertise from the ones who should know. And if you don't have tenure, in these days, unfortunately, universities are relying more and more on adjunct professors, junior professors, who don't have that, they don't yet have academic tenure. They don't have that freedom. And it's declined to almost, gosh, it's really getting low. And so there's very few people that can really, if they see something like this, they're better off walking away from it. Rather than getting themselves in trouble, because if they hold a 5-year or 2 or 3-year appointment, they won't get renewed. It's that simple. It's that simple. So I think the academic freedom, academic tenure sort of phenomenon or a program that we've lived with for all these years, I was a benefactor. And had I not had tenure, I can tell you for sure, I would never have written a China study. I would never be given all the lectures I give and speaking out like I do. It just wouldn't have happened.
Well, there's no doubt our country and our society would be much lesser for it. The name of the new book is The Future of Nutrition, and it's by my guest today, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, who is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'd like to talk about this a lot. Thanks.
T. Colin Campbell is Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. His new book is called The Future of Nutrition. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.